This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Keith McHenry. He's co-founder of Food Not Bombs. His latest book is The Anarchist Cookbook. It's coming out this fall from C-Sharp Press in Tucson. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great. Thanks for having me back. That's so cool.
It's really nice to have you back. Now, The Anarchist Cookbook, we have to clarify immediately that this is based on an old book from the 1970s with the exact same name, the same cover design. And that one was all about making do-it-yourself explosives and illegal drugs. Your book is about the peaceful side of anarchism, and the recipes are actually for healthy food. What is your relationship to the other book? Like, why did you base it on that reference?
Well, because many people know that I'm an anarchist and that I wrote a cookbook. I actually wrote two cookbooks, Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry, and Build Community, and my most recent book before this, Hungry for Peace. So they would buy the Anarchist Cookbook, because we don't really make a, you know, as anarchists, we're not like promoting our names or anything, and they just assume, well, he's an anarchist, he wrote a cookbook. They buy it and they go, it's just got bomb-making stuff, how to poison people, make booby traps. And I'd run into them at a, you know, conference or on the streets, and they go, you know, I didn't like your book, it's really terrible. So over the years, I'd hear that, and eventually Chaz Buffet is also an anarchist. He has an anarchist publishing company, and he published my other two books. And he was like, he and I would talk for years, we should just redo the book and rewrite it with real recipes and with information about anarchism, because the first book has nothing about anarchism at all. And so that's where the birth of it came from. And so after I finished the last book, we just started to write The Anarchist Cookbook. You know, the philosophies of anarchism are not about bombing things and poisoning people and harming things, but working cooperatively, having no hierarchy, being responsible for, like, determining the direction of your own community with the other members of your community. There's actually a really common saying in anarchism called anarchy is love. So the first Anarchist Cookbook has nothing to do with that. Unfortunately, William Powell, who wrote it, he wrote it when he was apparently very upset that he'd been drafted into the military in the Vietnam War and was facing, you know, the prospects. I don't know if he actually ultimately went to Vietnam, but he wrote this book based on information he got largely from the library, and it ended up like maligning the anarchist community horribly. And then years ago, he actually denounced his own book and said he wished it would go out of print. And as a result of reading that, we decided, okay, we will just rewrite it. We wrote him, initially he said it was fine, and then it took me a while to connect with him to try to get him to put something in the book, and he didn't really want to rewrite something apparently, so he said, just use the denunciation I have on Amazon, and then it was also covered in the Guardian, so we put that in the book.
So he denounced his own book. You've written a peaceful, healthy, loving, community-oriented anarchist cookbook that has no drugs or explosives or anything like that in it. And a very interesting book, because I think it's so interesting how you cover the rudiments of anarchism and what anarchism is. Because in a lot of people's mind, and, you know, for real historical reasons, anarchism is associated with violence.
Yes. And there's a debate in the anarchist community. There's a thing called diversity of tactics. And in fact, I had the great fortune to have Chris Hedges write the foreword to this book.
Yeah.
Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times journalist who was the Middle East bureau chief for many years. And he now has written quite a number of amazing books. And he wrote a piece about that Black Bloc is a cancer of Occupy. And a lot of us that are lifelong anarchists that have been doing this for, you know, organizing all kinds of actions and so on, have become, you know, in many cases frustrated with the Black Bloc. And
with the what?
What's called the Black Bloc. And so what had happened, for instance, what inspired Chris Hedges to write this was that there was a... the Occupy movement in 2011 was pretty expansive, and a lot was happening with it. And there was a huge protest to block the port of Oakland from Occupy Oakland. And then around that same time, a group of so-called black blockers went and broke out the windows at Whole Foods near the occupation, and the Whole Foods that's on the way to Berkeley. And the claim that they were doing it because some workers weren't allowed to take time off to join the protest. And all the media was about the breaking of the windows. And no one knows that like tens of thousands of people had gone out to block the port of Oakland. And a lot of the message of what all these middle-class Americans and poor Americans had all joined Occupy because you had the housing foreclosure crisis. The banks had robbed, like, literally people's homes across America. And there was an economic crisis that the taxpayers bailed out. So people were trying to make that statement in Occupy, and instead it became a statement of, well, the occupiers are so violent, they break out windows. And that gave the excuse. That actually made it legitimate for Occupy to be shut down in Oakland, and it also had repercussions across the country. So he wrote something about that. A friend of mine, Rebecca Solnit, actually wrote a much more detailed account criticizing the same event. And so we've had this kind of struggle in the anarchist community. In many cases, I've traveled to the Philippines. I think the last time we spoke, I was on my way to the Philippines or just back. I met with Food Not Bombs activists there, and they're all excited that maybe I was in the Black Bloc in Seattle in 99, where the windows at Starbucks were broken out and the windows at Nike were broken out. And I explained, really, you know, that's all you ever heard in the media, but the reality is several hundred thousand people shut down the World Trade Organization in November of 99, and they had to cancel their summit. And it had an impact on the ability to basically transfer power from the people to the corporations, which was what the purpose of that summit was. And so we've noticed over, you know, the advent of the Black Bloc that it's kind of disrupted things. And so that's why, you know, and I think particularly Rebecca Solnit's article talks about how we almost achieved some kind of change where we get a lot of people interested in the ideas of anarchism and what we're talking about. And then the Black Bloc does something, and then that whole campaign dies as a direct result, because then the media can portray us as being these violent people. And then we'll do it again. And she recounts several cases, which I was also involved with, where we were making forward movement on some series of actions, like against the war in Iraq or something like that, where then the propaganda aspect that could be used for the violence of people breaking out windows is used against us. But I also write in the book that I'm not necessarily opposed to property damage. It's just a matter of how it's done. So, for instance, there's a group of farmers that went to a McDonald's who felt threatened by McDonald's coming into France. And they were doing organic farming. They were selling locally. They were trying to be sustainable. They were trying to promote local cuisine, French cuisine. McDonald's moves in. They all march en masse with tractors or farm equipment, and they dismantle the entire McDonald's and donate the materials to build a place for the poor. So that's property damage, but they all were there, proud to do it, not wearing bandanas over their face like they were bank robbers, things like that. So, you know, that nuance needs to be clarified.
What happened with that? Yeah, I mean, did McDonald's build another one, or did it work?
They did not build one there, I don't believe. But what was amazing was that it was probably the spark that created the dialogue about McDonald's. And it's kind of the inspiration, for instance, for the slow food movement. The people went to jail and did some time, but they became like spokespeople for the anti-globalization movement. And that kind of helped be the birth of that. So it actually inspired like a lot of social change. Even if that specific McDonald's, I don't know the nature of whether they continued or not in that, but it was a huge inspiration. And I have another acquaintance of mine, Free, Jeff Lars, who did a anti-climate change action in Eugene years ago. And he burned down some SUVs. Well, and looking at it, he ended up being sentenced to a long prison sentence. It really disrupted the Eugene movement. Caused a lot of chaos. Food Not Bombs ended up going into hibernation because of all the paranoia by the FBI infiltration and so on. And then I got invited back to Eugene to try to help restart Food Not Bombs and restart the movement in a positive way. And there's been a lot of discussion that if had that action been that a lot of people went to that Hummer dealership and sat on all the Hummers with signs about climate change, did a bunch of stuff, they would have, it actually, instead of the Hummer dealership just having insurance pay to buy some more Hummers and then maligning people working against climate change, you know, it might have actually had a greater impact. In Santa Fe, actually, now there's been a conference back on the anniversary, the 70th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where nonviolent activists are speaking about these ideas. And there's a lot of evidence that nonviolent direct action ultimately creates the change that sticks, whereas, you know, if you're doing an armed revolution or whatever, then you end up having to be an armed society to defend your position, and then it just, the violence perpetuates.
We're talking to Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, whose new book is called The Anarchist Cookbook. And I think, I mean, it's such an interesting thing for the reader to go on this journey with you, because you've been on the front lines of social change and you've devoted your life to organizing. And you have a pretty good sense of what works and what doesn't. What are some of the strategies that you've let go of over the years?
Well, you know, I think one of them is the kind of the one-off organizing for this one day only and putting all your energy into that. And what I've noticed is that, and so that, particularly when you're younger, you know, when I was in my, like, 20s, you know, I spent a lot of energy organizing for the June 12th, 1982, March for nuclear disarmament. And that was actually a really important march. About a million people roughly showed up to the Great Meadow and, you know, in New York City. And it was a really, you know, it was a pivotal event. And it did have, like, a really big impact in a lot of ways. But what I noticed was that doing something all the time, like Food Not Bombs, where you go out every week with a vegan meal and you have literature and a banner and you try to talk to regular people who normally would never deal with what you're talking about, have no idea what's going on, that long haul, thinking of the long view is what really works, and not necessarily the big dramatic thing, and building personal relationships with people that you meet on the streets randomly who come up and enjoy a meal with a homeless person that maybe never have considered eating with, you know, and that kind of thing can have ultimately the larger impact. So that's one of the things I think I've learned over the years, is just to persist, just to keep happening. The other thing I've noticed is that, you know, really the combination of literature and a banner and a direct service like food, or direct service like squatting, which I put information in. I helped start a group called Homes Not Jails in the 90s in San Francisco, where we took over foreclosed properties that the bank was in dispute over, and then we'd house homeless people. And that this kind of thing would really touch the people in a really serious way, because it helped them get ultimately off the street. While they might not have squatted that building for very long, it gave them a break from living on the street enough often to get a job and an apartment and things like that. And so then years later, people come back to me and say that really made a big impact on me. And the other thing I've learned through this whole time is my first two books, Food Not Bombs, How to Feed the Hungry and Build Community, and Hungry for Peace, I don't mention anarchism per se. I don't use the word anarchism because of this stigma that has been often intentionally promoted as anarchism is chaos, whereas really capitalism is chaos, and anarchism is self-rule. It's really pure democracy, something that it's a very American background. One of the first people to sort of talk about the ideas that become called anarchism, a term that was coined by a French activist, was Henry David Thoreau, and he, in his Act of Civil Disobedience, and is really where the roots of modern anarchism come from. So it couldn't be more all-American and patriotic, really, in a certain odd sense.
Well, in an odd sense. I mean, anarchism literally means no government, and we are all about the beauty of our Constitution and the principles that inform our government. That doesn't mean that we're living by them anymore.
Correct.
But we do, on some level, believe in the principles of our own government.
Yeah, and I think Americans actually... So what I found was, by doing Food Not Bombs, We have three principles: that the food is always vegan or vegetarian and free to anyone without restriction. That the second one is that there's no leaders or rulers or a headquarters, that every group makes decisions using the process called consensus. And that the third is that we're dedicated to nonviolent direct action to change society. So the thing that people find is they join Food Not Bombs, and they might be have no politics. They may be just had seen homeless people and were upset to, that they were not getting food, or they were interested in animal rights, or they were, had a, an interest in defending the environment, or some kind of thing like that. And they become involved in Food Not Bombs, and then they have to practice, ultimately, anarchism the whole time. And so it's really, to me, the most important thing is the principles of anarchism, not whether you are labeled an anarchist or not labeled an anarchist. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, I remember in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down, in the left in America, the different communist parties had the resources. They kind of ran all the protests. They dominated the literature. They were a big deal. And then there became a lot of infighting with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that's really when the advent of anarchism really started to become renewed in the United States again. It had kind of died out after World War I, when anarchism in the United States was huge, when people like Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman were active, working for things like, you know, anarchist Helen Keller, for instance, is a famous anarchist.
Helen Keller was an anarchist?
Yeah. So there's been a lot of the people that Americans revere were overtly anarchists, wrote anarchist literature, gave anarchist speeches. You know, the anarchists were responsible for the birth control movement in the United States to legalize birth control. Anarchists played a huge role in legalizing abortion in the United States. We were the people that are responsible for the fact that people have an 8-hour work day and that they get vacations. Those are all things that we would not have if the anarchist community hadn't been behind them. So
when you say practice anarchism, tell us what that is like in real life. I mean, we're talking about consensus decision-making. We're talking about community organizing.
Yes, and basically not feeling, and it depends on the people, but not like bending to or expecting that things are going to happen by a higher authority, whether in some cases like the Pope or something like that, or, you know, the church,
Washington,
or Washington, D.C., the government, that we actually are going to take control of our own destiny, and that we're going to, like, you know, mold the way that we want the world to be and have total responsibility. We're not going to hope that a corporation funds something or something like that. So the, and I think at its root right now, because it's always changes over time, as because I think that's also an important part of anarchism, is you try to deal with the way the world really is right now, as opposed to some theoretical idea, which I think was part of the failure of a lot of Marxist groups. You deal with the environment and situation as it really is. So a lot of anarchists are involved in things like, I have the thing called the Food Not Bombs Free School in Taos, where we like work on organic gardening, we do natural building, this kind of thing, where we're going to replace the capitalist system that currently exists of exploitation with one that is life-affirming, which is people can be proud of living in, which is going to be healthy, which is not going to be contributing to the collapse of the climate and of just our basic ability, and that we resist all things like prisons and any kind of coercion, domination, and exploitation. That's like we're organizing around that, and it all can depend on what part of the world you're in, at what time of history you're in.
It sounds also like it's very earth-based and kind of low-tech.
It can definitely be that, although there's some amazing, there's a person by the name of Jeremy Hamden, who is in prison, was a former Food Not Bombs activist, who hacked into Stratfor's website and shared it with the world. So there's anarchists that are actually do that kind of thing. So there, and there's different versions. There's primitivists that are like green anarchy, which is completely like go back to, you know, like Stone Age time. So there's big debates about that. Then you have like syndicalists, which are people that are organizing around, think that there should be unions that are worker-led cooperatives. a very unusual anarchist thing that's happening right now is that the only people to defeat ISIS, and this is like not nonviolent, but I do write about it in Anarchist Cookbook, are anarchists. And they're the only people to have defeated ISIS, and they're doing this on the Syrian-Turkish border. And the U.S. just this week announced they would go to war against this anarchist community because of they want to use the air bases in Turkey to fight ISIS. Yet the only areas that have been liberated from ISIS in Syria and Iraq have been liberated by an anarchist community.
How did they do it?
They actually did use guns and tanks and so on, but the thing about it that was different than what the Iraqi military and the U.S. military have been able to do is that they actually have no hierarchy of the organization of their movement. They're Kurdish people. They used to be part of the Kurdish Workers' Party. Their leader actually became influenced by an anarchist named Murray Bookchin, who was an acquaintance of mine from Vermont, and he was in prison and started reading Murray Bookchin's books on anarchism, and he encouraged his movement to leave Stalinist Marxist background that they were doing to liberate Kurdistan, and they created this amazing constitution, which I talk about in the book, where all people are like equal. They don't have leaders. They make decisions by consensus, and that process has provided the success that they've been more fluid. They didn't have this rigid hierarchy, and since ISIS sort of operates potentially that same way, not that I necessarily know how that is, they've been able to defeat them. And they took huge amounts of territory from ISIS, and the only victories in the war against ISIS have been as a result of this anarchist community, which has created a free state on the border between Turkey and Syria and Iraq.
And you attribute that to their non-hierarchical organization?
I think that's part of it, and their vision that they're creating a world where everybody will be equal, so which is much higher motivation than the Iraqi military, which just ran, right? They just fled when ISIS came because they weren't fighting for, they were just essentially fighting for leaders and a hierarchy, and they did, why risk your life for that, where these people are risking their lives to actually, and they're living the anarchism at the same time they are fighting against ISIS in their own indigenous land, where they're, you know, their homeland, you know, the Kurdish areas between Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. So I think they're more highly motivated, and they have much more to gain. They're not going to just defeat ISIS and then get like a paycheck. They're going to defeat ISIS and have a free area of the world, and they all have an equal say in the direction. There's a lot of women are on the front lines of this, and there's been some pretty amazing documentaries about their work, and they're real, you know, they're just much more highly motivated because, you know, they're making the decisions themselves. They're not being told, go fight over there, follow my orders. They're going, oh, why don't we all make a decision of where to go and what to do and what the strategy is. And they've, you know, had huge success. And it's, I think it's interesting. They're the only ones to defeat ISIS out of any groups.
We're talking to Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs and author of several books. His latest is The Anarchist Cookbook. One thing that I've always found to be a kind of strange paradox that has to continually be dealt with is that even in leaderless systems, there are natural leaders who emerge. You're one of them.
Uh-huh.
And so how do you work with consensus and an ideological non-leadership-based organization as a leader?
Well, you have to de-emphasize your leadership, which can be really hard and can be quite a struggle, because if you have people that are real flakes and not get anything done, it can be a tad frustrating. But I think the success of Food Not Bombs and the natural aspect of it being based on the theories of anarchism, the principles of anarchism, is that, you know, I might have designed the logo, written a book, speak to people, go on radio, things like that, but we created this principles that we don't own. And the logo anybody can use. They can modify the logo however they want. They don't even need to use the name. They can alter the name how they feel. Just give it away. The main idea is to encourage or to inspire people to step up and make decisions themselves, to know that they have that right to do that, that they're encouraged to do that, and that they're not going to be following me. And in fact, I probably have less power in the Food Not Bombs community because I am a co-founder, because people were trying to reject any hierarchy. So if I go to a Food Not Bombs gathering where there's like Food Not Bombs activists from all over the world or all over a state or something, my opinion actually generally counts less than almost anybody else's, because there's such a concern of there being somebody in a hierarchical position. So if you're a lifelong anarchist, you often have developed a way of speaking subtly, which people occasionally point out to me, where I'm not telling you to do something, but I'm suggesting that you might do this or that. And actually my partner, Abby Samuels, can be kind of frustrated with that, because she sort of wants there to be like a definitive this or that. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to dictate what's going on. And, that I'm not going to say, go here, go there, do that, do this, or whatever. I might suggest, and it might be a little more subtle than some people like Abby are used to. But that's the thing. I'm not going to tell people to do something or you might be doing something pretty annoying, and I might use the term, well, I suggest you not continue to trash whatever it is, be helpful.
Now, last time you were on the program, I guess it was a couple of years ago now, we were talking about the criminalization of homelessness and the criminalization of feeding people who are homeless. What's happened in the intervening years? What have you seen? Have there been any improvements? What are you seeing on the ground?
Well, right now there's 71 cities that have laws either restricting or banning the sharing of free food with the hungry in the United States.
And which is insane.
Yeah.
Call it what it is.
Yeah, it's absolutely outrageous. And most recently people are aware of a Fort Lauderdale crisis where the most famous person to be arrested was Arnold Abbott, this fairly amazing man who has dedicated his entire retirement for like 15, 20 years. He's a 90-year-old World War II vet to feeding the homeless in Fort Lauderdale. And Food Not Bombs activists got arrested there and jailed for this. And there's now pending lawsuits. So the city is like in a situation where they can't bust the people. And they also received a horrible amount of publicity about it, and hopefully are kind of embarrassed that they ever did it. So that's the last conflict around the sharing of free food. Now, in Santa Cruz, which is the other place that I live besides Taos, in Santa Cruz, California, they just shut down a large aspect of the shelter for the homeless, and they got eliminated showers in Santa Cruz, both not only at the homeless shelter but also out at the beach for surfers, so that was often a way that people could get showers. So we started offering showers at the Food Not Bombs meal and things like that. So
why did they eliminate showers?
They're claiming, for the shelter, why they eliminated that was they said they didn't get enough federal funding. And they acted like they were surprised, but it was actually, some people admitted they've known for, years that one grant from HUD was going to end, and they never went to reapply. But there's some speculation that it's actually they want to reorient their whole, philosophy of how to deal with homeless people and stuff. And part of it is just to have so-called long-term transitional housing and get the emergency issue, like just abandon that, the people living on the streets that need to get off just for the night. So there's lots. It's not clear really what the actual motivation behind that was. And then they're saying that they stopped the showers at the beaches to save water because of the drought in California. And, so there's an interest. So we started this campaign of sleepouts where we're sleeping in front of Santa Cruz City Hall the day of the city council meeting. And we've been having about roughly 30 people, 15 homeless people and 15 house people, all sleeping together illegally, because there's a law against sleeping outside and camping outside in Santa Cruz, as there is in many cities. And there's a number of such campaigns happening around the United States. And in the last, yesterday, the August 15th, August 5th, there was I guess it wasn't yesterday, but 2 days ago, there was a ruling by a federal court in Idaho that laws against the homeless, particularly things like sleeping and camping, are unconstitutional because it's cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And so there's a lot of us activists that are like, hey, well, you know, check that out. You know, that's a court maybe doing it. And as an anarchist, like, you know, I'm not that impressed by courts, but it was very well-written decision and really good. It's saying what we're saying. And here it is, a court saying that. And also in Santa Cruz, a grand jury came out and denounced the policies of the county and of the town of Santa Cruz for their brutal treatment of the homeless and their lack of offering. You know, we're one of the, you know, people from Google and places like that live in Santa Cruz. You know, a modest house is like over $1 million. It's the most expensive place possible to rent or to buy, and there's a housing shortage, and so there's plenty of resources, but nobody's doing anything about it. And I think that's symptomatic of what's going on across the whole United States. You know, we have this huge increase in homelessness and poverty, while others are getting super rich. You know, and I think that's something anarchists have been struggling with since the very beginning.
I mean, the erosion of the middle, whether it be the middle class or almost anywhere you look, even moderate wings of political parties, they're going away. We're living in a country of ever-increasing extremes. But also, I think more consciousness of it. I mean, certainly the consciousness of police brutality and police racism has increased quite a lot over the last few years.
Yeah, that's really pretty astounding, and largely due to that's a technological advance where people have cell phones and can videotape the level of violence that, and then put it on YouTube and Tumblr and Twitter and stuff.
And ironically, their own dash cams and lapel recorders and things like that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. But and so there's also a debate. I mean, I was involved in founding a group called October 22nd No Police Brutality Day back after the Rodney King beatings in the 90s. And we organized a campaign called Stolen Lives. And we had estimated that over 50,000 people were killed by the police in 10 years. So that's almost the same as the number of U.S. troops that died in Vietnam. You know, 57,000 is what the number there is.
Oh, my goodness.
So now,
it'd be like if they killed every single person in, almost every single person in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Over a period of 10 years.
Over 10 years. Yeah. Now it was over 600 confirmed deaths by cops in the United States just in half a year, this past year. So it's, you know, some people wonder whether it's, you know, we don't have, it's only recently that Holder, the former Attorney General Holder, said the FBI would start compiling statistics on how many citizen deaths there are by police in the United States. And there's also been some indictments finally of cops for murdering people, but that which never used to happen. So there's a lot of movement in that regard. And also the issue of racism is to the fore, Black Lives Matter being inspiring huge amounts of debate on why is it so many people of color particularly and so many black young men that are being killed. And so that debate, I think there's a real breaking open of society now, in part because of corporations which are, on one hand, exploiting people, but on the other hand, have inspired new technologies like, I have to say that Facebook was actually, quite frankly, an invention of anarchists in Australia who figured out how to do basically all that self-posting stuff for indie media before the Seattle protest in 99. But, you know, we gave it away, and Facebook is profiting from it. So kind of ironic. But at the same time, it's been very helpful to activist community.
We're talking to Keith McHenry, and he is, among other things, the author of this new book, The Anarchist Cookbook, not to be confused with the old book, The Anarchist Cookbook. And let's talk for a moment about the recipes in the back of the book. You actually did include quite a lot of recipes, and it's for feeding sort of larger amounts of people.
Well, I have it divided into two parts. Chaz actually suggested this because the last book, Hungry for Peace, I have it for vegan recipes for 6 and vegan recipes for 100. In this case, we have, like, the first section is for, you know, families of 6 or groups of people for 6, and the second and the other half is for large groups, so like for 100. And, we are trying to point out in this book very strongly the importance of, if you're nonviolent, one of the really important thing is to also be nonviolent against other species and against the earth. And so we strongly promote the idea of vegan recipes. I mean, the recipes are vegan. And that's growing more and more important as we're seeing, like, the United Nations itself even, and several other scientific groups have reported that probably the single leading cause of climate change is animal agriculture. And you can see that in California, the single largest cause of the drought is animal agriculture. So, and that's both directly from water use for animal agriculture, and at the same time, the fact that animal agriculture has increased climate change, which has reduced rainfall and snowpack in the Sierra Nevada. So, both those things are coming together as a crisis because of animal agriculture. But also, if you're working to end war, and anarchists have spent a lot of, you know, the one of the big things for anarchists, and we're refusing to fight in the capitalist war in Europe in World War One, and then again in World War Two, and then of course in the Vietnam and all the other wars. War is the health of the state is an anarchist slogan, and so if you're going to be nonviolent, you're advocating nonviolence, you know, against people because and against war. Just equally as important to be nonviolent against animals. And so I write a lot about that, and I write a lot about the before even the recipes, I write about the philosophy of why these recipes are vegan. And, you know, much of the poisoning of the sea, for instance, is due to animal agriculture and the threat to our food safety through genetically modified foods. One of the leading causes of world hunger is the genetically modified crops. And people, even though people think, oh, well, that's how we're going to end world hunger, it actually turns out to be increasing world hunger.
How's that?
And how it is doing that is it's taking control of seeds and of crops away from farmers, and making it so that every year you have to buy genetically modified crops. And over 100,000 farmers have committed suicide because they can't pay their bills to, you know, to get another season's worth of seeds because they're banned from saving their seeds, or their seeds need activator chemicals because they've been bought through Monsanto or something of that nature. And so this huge... one of the things that really struck me, which I relate in the book, is that when you lose 100,000 farmers who leave their fields because they've killed themselves, this is according to this was published in a number of places in England, but people have done. There's actually an official bureau in India that's kept track of this. That's I know from gardening for 40 years myself, that's knowledge that is lost to the world. But it's also fields that have been lost to the world and food. And, you know, still to this day, 70%, between 50 and 70% of all food is actually grown by women on subsistence farms, according to the World Food Organization.
Now, they're not the ones who are committing suicide.
No, these are actually commercial farmers that have, because of the WTO and other trade agreements, have been forced into buying genetically modified seeds and chemicals to grow their food.
We're talking to Keith McHenry, and I wanted to ask you, I mean, when you devote your entire life, as you have, decades, to social change, to political organizing, to feeding the homeless, to really bringing attention to the worst travesties of our industrial system, you always, I'm going to guess, have in mind some kind of vision of a world in which you would like to live, in which maybe you don't have to fight these fights so much.
Yeah, well, that vision, and oddly enough, it's becoming more and more popular, which is fortunate, since that's what I've been trying to do by getting out on the streets, providing free food to people, and promoting the idea of vegan and no exploitation, is a world where it's not dominated by corporate control, where money and capitalism isn't the ruling system, where less and less animals are tortured and eaten and suffer as a result of animal exploitation. And there's like a link in all these things. What Funa Bombs has done for the 35 years is to try to show the connections between your like own personal diet and your own concern for your own health and that of the health of the community and the health of the earth. And that people are, you know, growing more and more to understand that that's more important. And sadly, a lot of times that's because more of a crisis like Sandy or Katrina or a drought or forest fires or the fact you're becoming homeless because of the economic conditions. But to empower people to really direct their own community and to have more self-esteem that they can make a difference and they can control their own destiny, and at the same time to do it cooperatively. So there's kind of two large trends of anarchism, so to speak. You might have the Ron Paul libertarian, Scott Walker type of anarchism, where the toughest, strongest, wealthiest people dominate and control everything, and there's no rules type of libertarian anarchism. Or you could have like an anarchism that my community reflects, which is one where we all work together and we like try to do the best for everyone within our own community, but that we're not being dictated to from outside or from above in any of those decisions. And I'm really, and I do think that has been slowly happening. You know, it might not ultimately be happen in my lifetime, but that's the direction I'd like to see. And I think you have like anti-labeling laws or pro-labeling GMO laws happening and struggle there. There's a consciousness that homeless people are the same as us and deserve the same civil rights. You have the animal, you know, I just went to the National Animal Rights Conference, and when I first started going, it was like 600-700 people. It was 1,600 people registered this time, so a lot more people are building those connections. And so I really hope that we do have this kind of where the federal government and the corporations are not dominating everything, where state government is not dominating everything, but that people are like respecting each other's rights, that they're not like harming each other or feeling that they need to steal or things like that out of desperation, but that instead they feel like, okay, we can work together to make our community the most beautiful, healthy, and sustainable community possible. And that's really at the root of anarchism.
How are things in Taos? You were talking about Santa Cruz, but you also spend a good chunk of your life living in Taos.
Yeah, I have the Funa Bombs Free School, which is started by a group of Funa Bombs activists, where people come in for a couple of weeks to, in like 2-week segments. Sometimes people do many 2-week segments during the summer. And we do workshops depending, of course, on the season, on either, preparing beds and planting seeds or maintaining the gardens or harvesting and preserving. And then we have other workshops on things like adobe brick building. We just made an Orno. We had like about 35 people from the community come to this Orno adobe oven building workshop. We have another one coming up. We live in tents and in a teepee, and I live in a school bus called Katrina, which was the bus that was the second bus to New Orleans after Katrina. And something that Funa Bombs did was provide the vegan meals. We provide all the meals, or majority of the meals, for the people in New Orleans in the days after Katrina. And so we'll do those kind of things. We'll talk about activism. We'll do media things. We've done puppet workshops. We've done we just did a medical herbs as medicine workshop and how to collect them and dry them and prepare them. And it's based on anarchist principles. So when we start each of the 2 weeks periods, we talk about what it is we want to do as workshops, and everyone has equal say. There's not like I'm telling you that we're going to have these 7 workshops and you have to do them and show up at this time. We all collectively, all the people there, usually it can be like, from as little as 5 or 6 people there up to we've had 16 to 20 people living on this land in El Prado. And so we make these decisions, and then we may even alter those decisions at breakfast. We go on hikes. We go swimming in the Rio Grande. We built a shower. We're building a solar We're building a little building where it will be solar hot water for your shower. We're outdoor kitchen. We like doing gray water, experimenting with that. So we do all those kinds of things. And the idea is you leave the free school to do Food Not Bombs and to really try to change the world somewhere else. So trying to send people out. And it's modeled a little bit after Highlander School, where Rosa Parks studied before she did the bus boycott.
Now, how do you make a living? I mean, is there any cash infusion into the life that you're living?
Well, this is what I, fortunately, what I do, as some people may know, I was blacklisted after 9/11, so I'm not allowed officially to work in the United States. So what I do to make my own personal money is I speak at colleges, and I sell, my books, and then things like my cell phone is a Food Not Bombs cell phone, because it's the toll-free number, 1-800-884-1136, for homeless people to call to find out where food is or other things like that. So I keep my expenses really low, and the main thing I have to pay for is, to maintain the where I stay in my bus in Taos, or to, fortunately, my partner pays most of the bills in Santa Cruz, which is way too expensive, but I pay the utilities and help out with that. And I just live very marginally. And that's what I've always done, basically, even when I did have a job before I got blacklisted by Homeland Security.
Being blacklisted by Homeland Security, what does that mean?
Well, what it meant to me is three different employees brought me in, or employers brought me into their office and said that they were contacted. Actually, oddly enough, in the first two cases, it was Vice President of Raytheon Missile Systems, who explained to them that I was blacklisted and not allowed to work in the United States.
But why? How did that
because
happen?
Because I'm a when I was declared one of America's most hardcore terrorists in 1988, in September of 88, and until 9/11 happened, and that meant basically I got arrested and beaten for sharing free food. I did 2 years in jail. And
this was all about giving away food?
It's actually what we understand is, and this is from a State Department, it's also from police statements, where they said that they didn't mind we're feeding the hungry, but that we're making a political statement, and that is not allowed. And then when they started learning about anarchism, Dennis Martell, the captain of the San Francisco police, told the media that they didn't mind we were feeding the homeless, it's that we were making an anarchist-type statement, and that was not allowed. So that was the official version of the San Francisco Police Department. The U.S. State Department, however, compared us to Al-Qaeda in a lecture that they gave at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy in Medford, Massachusetts, and that was aired on C-SPAN in April 2009, where they asked the question, who's more dangerous, Al-Qaeda or the people that share the vegan meals in the park? And they said that the people sharing the vegan meals in the park were more dangerous because they were convincing the American public that money should be diverted from military spending towards education, health care, and other domestic needs, and that we were likely to last another 30 years, whereas Al-Qaeda would not last probably even 20.
And for that, you were labeled a terrorist?
And I was labeled a terrorist, correct. And Food Not Bombs was labeled a terrorist, and I was on the... I got documents in discovery showing I was on the terrorist watch list for both the FBI and Homeland Security, and I was actually removed from a plane and on a flight that came from... When I got to Chicago, from a flight from Istanbul to Heathrow to Chicago, where they took me to a room and then asked me how I was associated with the violent group Food Not Bombs and what was my role in the violent group Food Not Bombs. They also asked me how I made a living. I was also pulled out of my vehicle at gunpoint when entering the United States north of Burlington, Vermont on a tour I was on, and held there by Border and Customs. I was held on the way into the United States from Mexico because at the time my girlfriend was from Turkey, and I come up on a list like that made it particularly more crazy that I had a Muslim partner. And so I've had those kinds of things happen. And I've regularly have my mail confiscated for months at a time, according to Senator Udall's office here in New Mexico, that the FBI just says confiscates my mail for periodically before particularly large events like the Republican-Democratic National Convention in 2008. My mail was held for 8 months. My bank account, the Funabom's bank account, disappeared until after the election, where it reappeared, things of that nature. So.
Well, George Orwell, wherever you are, your world has come into being. That's all I can say.
Yep, fellow anarchist, George Orwell, yes.
Well, Keith McHenry, it's always great to have you on the air. It's unfortunately time to go, but I want to let people know we've been talking to Keith McHenry, who has written the book, The Anarchist Cookbook. It's the new version of it, which is all about food and peace and the peaceful side of anarchism. He's co-founder of Food Not Bombs. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's exciting to be on your program. I'll keep tuning in.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.